there's this the pre-Bitcoin you and the post-Bitcoin you. So, you know, like you're a born again Bitcoiner. And the level of conviction 100%. That kind of goes along with that, that's not priced in, you know? Like, there are so many Bitcoiners that are willing to go down with the ship. Like, it's Bitcoin or bust, baby. It's just, this thing has to work because it's our only chance. There's, you know, this is the arc.
Hello, everyone. I'm John Chenow, and welcome to episode 6 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. I'm thrilled to have Gigi on for today's pod. Gigi is Bitcoiner and Austrian, writing words and code for Bitcoin. His first book, 21 Lessons, is one of the most recommended books among Bitcoiners. He has launched various projects in the Bitcoin space and is currently working on his second book called 21 Ways. His main focus is on privacy, security, free software, open source education, and of course, Bitcoin. We get into some fascinating discussion around the value of personal privacy, the value of Bitcoin as a final settlement payment system, the tension between the investment side of the community and the private sovereignty-focused Bitcoiners. We talk about how Bitcoin combines the best of ledger-based money and token-based money, and the potential dark side of Bitcoinization and what blind spots we might have at the moment. You can learn more about Gigi and see his latest work by going to dergigi.com. That's dergigi.com. And follow him on Twitter at dergigi, dergigi. Before we get into our talk, I just want to let you know about an online event coming up this weekend. It's an online virtual Bitcoin conference, December 12th and the 13th. It's an opportunity to deepen your understanding of Bitcoin in a compressed amount of time with some of the most well-respected educators in space. One of the things that Gigi and I talk about is the multifaceted nature of the Bitcoin journey and how it takes time for the concepts to really sink in. That's why I'm gathering these 6 experts for an educational experience with this cosmic deep dive event. I want to help people shorten their learning curve by spending 2 days straight with experts learning and going deeper into the rabbit hole with other like-minded people who have been around a little longer and can serve as guides and help you along your journey. The speakers for the conference are Robert Breedlove, Dan Held, John Vallis, Eric Kaysen, Max Hillebrand, and Gigi, who we're speaking with today. And registration is at cosmicdeepdive.com. There are limited seats, so be sure to reserve your spot. And time is of the essence. It's coming up this Saturday, so be sure to get in there and reserve your spot. I'll look forward to seeing you there. And with that, let's get into my conversation with Gigi. Dude, that's awesome. Wow.
So welcome to the Bitcoin Renaissance, where everyone can be invisible if he wants to.
Dude, I love it. I love it, man. I'm talking to a ghost from the Bitcoin future.
Yeah, that's right.
That's rad. Well, let's just hit it off, man. Gigi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I see that you are you're coming to us from a distant land that looks pretty mysterious. Can you tell us about that? What's it like over there?
Yeah, I just materialized like 2 seconds ago in front of the screen. So all of this is kind of weird. But as Brady likes to say, you know, we're at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. And I try to visualize that from time to time with futuristic artworks and the rising Bitcoin sun. And yeah, I'm currently working on my on my studio setup so I can appear on camera as a pseudonymous faceless Bitcoiner. And so that's like version 0.1. It's not perfect yet, but it's something. So now I'm a floating almost head. I'm missing a mouth, but I've got ears and eyes, and that's all right with me.
Well, I'm honored that you decide to make the debut of your online video presence on my podcast. It's an honor, man.
Yeah, that's like the beta test. The alpha test was with Alex Wetzky and Robert Breedlove. they had the same reaction as you. It was really hard to concentrate in the first couple of minutes because it's it's kind of weird talking to a floating head. But yeah.
No,
I think people will have to get used to a lot of weird things that will be coming in the next couple of years. So that's just one of them. You know, like weird internet people that have no face and just talk about things and write about things.
Dude, well, if there's anything that's true, that's like the same about every single aspect of my Bitcoin journey, it's been just like having to get used to some like crazy, ridiculous new thing, whether it's a new idea or like a way of using my computers and presenting myself on the internet. Like, so I imagine there's going to be way more of these things coming down the pike.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Bitcoin has this way of kind of shattering your preconceived notions about the world. Like you think you know what money is and you think you know how the world works, so to speak. And Bitcoin takes all these assumptions that you have and just shatters them completely. And so you start to fall down multiple rabbit holes simultaneously almost. And, you know, one day you're just browsing the internet and the next thing you know is that you only connect via Tor and you're compiling your Linux kernel yourself and stuff like that. And not trusting any Wi-Fi connection and just wiping your Android device and installing graphene on it and stuff like that. You know, like it never ends.
Yeah, man. I have to say, like, that is something that I've thought about. Like, I'm very much a pleb, a like non-technical person when it comes to a lot of this stuff initially. Interacting online under like a pseudonym and everything like that is, you know, something that I see the value of a lot, but at the same time, I struggle with wanting to just like be myself to my friends and family and like represent my ideas and what I'm learning. But also the safety and the privacy aspect of things. Like, I don't necessarily want everyone everywhere to know everything about what I'm thinking and what I'm doing. So like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's an interesting tension. I wonder,
yeah,
decide to, go ahead.
I think it's one of the most interesting tensions because I think we need both kind of things. Like, there definitely need to be outspoken people that put their real name and their real face behind it and their whole reputation behind it. But I think we also need on the fringes, the people that, you know, like 6102, for example, that don't really want to share their voice because now there are AI algorithms that try to guess how you look like just based on your voice and stuff like that. And I think it would be foolish to give up it would be foolish to give up privacy just willy-nilly. Like, we need those people that fight the good fight and fight for, like, just fight to normalize end-to-end encryption, for example. Normalize privacy. Normalize the use of pseudonyms. Normalize anonymity. Like, normalize all of that. Because I think what I liked most was... It was actually written by Christopher Pohl, the founder of 4chan. He wrote a piece very long ago, which I think I don't remember the headline anymore, but the main point was that identity is prismatic. And I think it's such a valuable idea to think about it, because you're not the same person. It depends on who you interact with. You know, like you're a different person when you interact with your wife. You're a different person when you interact with your boss. You're a different person when you go to a strip club. You're a different person when you are with your sports team and stuff like that. And I think just using a single identity.
Not me, man.
Like
I'm the same all around.
Well, yeah. I mean, good for you. Good for you.
Strip club, family.
There certainly are people like that. But you get my point. You know, it shouldn't be like society shouldn't force you to use your real name and your real identity and just the same. Society and technology shouldn't force you to be the same person everywhere on every platform and so on. And I also really like the cypherpunk ethos around that, because the whole idea is that in cyberspace you don't have to use your true name, to use Werner Winch's term, and so any threat of violence becomes meaningless because nobody knows who you are. So if nobody knows who you are, nobody can threaten you with violence, because there is no way to really exert violence in cyberspace. You know, like if they can't find you in meatspace, then what are they going to do? They can only flame you, you know, like they can only hurt your feelings. Mm-hmm. They cannot hurt your skin and bones. And while definitely many people argue nowadays that hurting your feelings equals violence, I definitely would not say that. And so if someone, if nobody knows who you are and where you live, then, you know, cyberspace is quite a safe place.
Yeah, that's a fascinating dynamic that it brings to business relationships, where because right now I think it's pretty well known, or it's pretty established, that as you build a reputation in a certain industry, that's extremely helpful for your business. But building that reputation does kind of add vulnerabilities as well of elements of attack, people knowing exactly who you are, what you look like. And so if they want to extort you for some reason, then they have the ability to do that, to use violence. And, you know, it brings to mind a buddy of mine who has a really successful online business, and he had a run-in with this vendor who was trying to sell him this kind of snake oil type product that he eventually got. He made an order and then he got the product and found out that it was shit, and he canceled it right away. He canceled his credit card, and he started talking about how he's going to like try to find him, where he lived, and fuck him up and all this crazy stuff. What I find fascinating is like, why when we're online and I'm making an order from a company who, it doesn't matter to them, like who I am, why do I have to provide so much personal information, like my name, my email, my phone number, my address, all of this stuff, just to like order online videos, like to get streaming service. You know what? Yeah, what wild. The fuck does Netflix care about, like who I am, if I'm giving them my $10 a month? So Bitcoin's changing that, right? Like we don't have to verify people's identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see that also in the real world. Like in meatspace, when you go to the bakery and you just want to have the bread, the baker isn't interested in your name or where you live or whatever. Like the transactions are way more like way more frictionless, and just it was simpler times, you know, like when you didn't pay your baker with Stripe or something, or with WeChat or what have you, you just hand over.
When you didn't have KYC
bearer asset, you know. Yeah, exactly. You have your dollar bill or whatever, and that's it. And I really hope that Bitcoin brings that back in the realm of cyberspace, but also in some way in meatspace, because of course nowadays most people pay with their phones or with the cards or with whatever payment mechanism they have. They don't really use cash anymore, but you know, you have NFC enabled cards, and you just tap your card on the checkout register and everything's paid. And of course, all of that only works, and all of it can only work because everything is tracked in the background, and everyone, like, you have those almost benevolent, godlike entities, the payment entities that know everything and that can say that, you know, like, this is all right and this transaction goes through and so on and so forth. And they kind of need to collect all this data because there is no other way to combat fraud. You know, like, we don't have instant settlement. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the problem. And that's why all of this creeped in. And this is also why Netflix and all the other services, they kind of need to know who they're dealing with, because otherwise they would have no way of dealing with fraud, pretty much. And, yes, and all of that is like a settlement issue. And with physical bearer assets, like with gold coins and dollar bills and so on, settlement is always instant. You either have the dollar bill or you don't. And Bitcoin works in the same way. And for example, everything that truly builds up on Bitcoin, like Lightning, the Lightning network, also works in the same mm-hmm. way. You have instant settlement, you have final settlement. Like, there is no reverse chargeback, whatever. Oh, the check did bounce, what have you. And I think, you know, most people don't really understand why the payment systems and pretty much the world works as it works today. It all has a reason. It's not necessarily the best reason or a good reason, but it all has a certain reason. It all evolved because of very crucial underlying issues. There was just no other way to do it. And now with Bitcoin, as you say, we have another way to do it. And I think it goes way beyond that. Like, this, all of this, in my opinion, is like, it's as inevitable as the internet ate everything. You know, like, the first people that understood the internet and what is ushering in, you would not buy a fax machine the next day. You know, like, you know, fax machines are obsolete, like, it's dead. And you know, many other things as well, you know, and all of this will play out. But I think what's really interesting is some use cases that aren't obvious, you know, and like Andreas Antonopoulos talked very earlier also about streaming money and so on. But I already saw use cases that were just impossible before. And for example, someone in the early days of Lightning, I saw it a couple of times, where someone was just, I just ordered it, and I got the payment request, like, I got the Lightning invoice, but I don't have enough money. Can someone pay it for me? And you just post the QR code on Twitter. And if someone is just, you know, in a good mood, he will just scan it and pay the $5 or whomever. And that's it. And nobody needs to know anything. And that's so cool. You know, like, you can take the receipt pretty much. And in the 20 minute time window where the receipt needs to be paid, it doesn't matter who pays it, you know, and nobody needs to know anyone. It's so cool. There are so many cool things that you can do with it. And of course, this is just the beginning. And we already see so many insanely cool shit built on Bitcoin. It's blowing my mind, you know, like, now Adam Curry with his podcasting 2.0 project and the Sphinx chat, just integrating it in pretty much like 2 weeks later. And you know, you have a chat platform completely decentralized, built up on Lightning, that streams podcasts, and you can just pay by the minute. And like, we have streaming sets already, you know, the future is already here. Just, it's not evenly distributed yet, to use this phrase. Nobody knows about it yet, you know, but it works. Like, I use it every day. It's so cool. We have our own podcast there and people tip us, and it's so insanely great. You know, like, it's a small German community, but it, all of it works, and it's amazing, you know, and it's just a couple of weeks old. So it's, I think it will melt people's brains what kind of things we're going to see down the road. And all of this is just the technical, fancy payment bells and whistles kind of stuff that most people aren't interested in. Like, as we said before we record, you know, there is this tension also of the number go up crowd and the privacy and cool technology and let's build out Lightning crowd. And the overlap isn't like, you know, there's a small overlap. There are some people that are interested in both, but most people currently see Bitcoin as pure digital gold, and that's the most important thing. And that's basically it, you know, like, it only has to be digital gold, and that's it. And it is it. I agree. Like, I'm not disagreeing, you know, but there are other things as well, you know, like, the internet is not only just a digital library, you know, the internet is not just the Library of Alexandria. Mm. It is, you know, like, no doubt about it. There's Wikipedia, there's the Internet Archive, there's like a billion books on it and what have you. But it's not only just there to store data. You can do a billion other things online, and it's so cool. Like, and so many niches will pop up. I think most people are completely unaware as they were with the internet.
Yeah, 100%. And I wonder with where a lot of that is coming from with Michael Saylor, for instance, who is saying, like, he's kind of downplaying the whole payments part of thing. To me, it almost seems like he gets it. He sees where it could go, but he doesn't want it to be this distracting thing. He doesn't want it to get like too much attention from the wrong people soon.
And
does that make sense? Like, is that kind of where it's coming from, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And also, I think it's also because he studied his Bitcoin history, and in the past it was very misguided, and just the whole, like, the whole block size debate and the whole four cores and everything, it was all around the narrative of store of value between media of exchange. It was all about like saving versus payments and so on. And so many people, you know, like, a lot of people have like post-traumatic stress disorder when people start talking about payments, and it's just, you know, like, no, it's not what Bitcoin is for and so on. But you know, like, Bitcoin is so many things. It's like all that, you know, like it, and all of it is interconnected, and all of it is super important. Bitcoin wouldn't be as good as a store of value if it wouldn't have uncensorable settlement built in, you know. And I'm choosing my words carefully, because it really is on the base layer. It's settlement. It's way more settlement than payments, because like paying someone on Bitcoin, you need to be patient. It needs the system works that it takes at least 10 minutes to settle, you know. And if you want to have final settlement, like quote unquote final, there is no finality, but a very like virtually final settlement, then it takes an hour at least. And of course you have to pay fees for that. So if you're cheap, then it might be 2 days, and it depends on usage and so on and so forth. And that's why we build Lightning, you know, like it circumvents all these problems on the payment and settlement side of things. And I don't think Lightning is the final answer, you know, like, I mean, we already know that there are many problems with Lightning, and that's why Ellen Markets popped up, for example. And you know, like it's not easy to keep your channels balanced and have a lot of inbound liquidity and stuff like that. So it's all of those problems are real, and they are nuanced. And I agree with Michael Saylor and everyone else, like the 99.9%, maybe even more, of the accruing value of Bitcoin will be because people just throw money into Bitcoin and just hodl and save. And you know, I'm in that camp as well. Like, you would be hard pressed to find someone that is as hard when it comes to stacking and hodling as I am. And I'm a huge advocate of just adopting a personal Bitcoin standard and just throwing all excess capital that you have, everything you can afford, into Bitcoin. Just auto DCA, set it and forget it, and just live the most minimalistic life that you can, and just write out Bitcoinization, hyper Bitcoinization as best as you can, because I think we haven't even started yet. Like, all surprises will be on the upside. We are before the early adopter phase. Like, we are still the insanely crazy ones, and like, it hasn't even started yet. And it's insane to talk about it, because Bitcoin is already at like 18K, like $18,000 or something. And to like, you know, I the last 2 years I started talking about this, and I was always on the very fringes, and you know, like, even Bitcoin has called me crazy. And yeah, I say now, let's just see where it's going. I have the feeling that I'm more right than I was wrong, you know. Like, I'm just thinking in orders of magnitude. If you zoom out far enough, the large S curve that is Bitcoin adoption, like global Bitcoin adoption, just as we are talking about internet adoption, you know, like, internet adoption isn't even done. There's like a billion people plus that don't have internet yet. So we're not even done with the large S curve when it comes to internet adoption. We're definitely not done when it comes to Bitcoin adoption. Like, the S hasn't even started yet. We're still flatlining, you know. If you zoom out far enough, and it's like a very large S from 0% penetration to 100% penetration, everyone uses Bitcoin, we're still pretty much at 0%. Like nobody uses Bitcoin. And so it hasn't even started yet. You know, like one million US dollars per Bitcoin is so insanely conservative because you're still thinking in US dollars. I think the fund really will start, and that's my definition pretty much of hyper Bitcoinization, is if the global collapse of all fiat currencies and you don't have a measuring stick left. So you will have to determine how much is a Satoshi worth? You know, you have to see, okay, I can take my 200 Satoshis and I can buy 5 stakes with it. And that's how you will do your calculation. It wouldn't make sense to talk in US dollar or euro or yen terms, just like it doesn't make sense to talk in Venezuelan Bolivar terms, you know, like what's Bitcoin worth in Venezuela? It's infinity, you know, it's because, yeah, well, the fiat currency is worthless and all fiat currencies share that. They don't have any real value. And I'm not going down the intrinsic value route or anything, but it's just, you know, it's a made up construct. Some other people buy fiat. That's why they are fiat currencies. They say this now has value and I force you with all the violence I can exert to use this thing because I say so. I say it has value. And Bitcoin is very, very different. And I think we see the devaluation happening right now with or without Bitcoin, you know, like even before Bitcoin existed, the US dollar lost like 95% or even more, 99% of its purchasing power since its inception. And that's the fate of all fiat currencies. If you study history, like all fiat currencies trend towards zero and they either get replaced or they strike out three zeros or they reinvent another currency or what have you. And it will either end in, you know, like in war or in hyperinflation or both at the same time. It's just always catastrophic. It's a system that is purposefully set up to be not in equilibrium, and a small group of people benefit from this system. This is also why it's so wrong and so evil. But you know, that's a separate discussion, and I think Robert Breedlove would be the right person to talk about it. I think I'm not, but still, it's. Once you understand all that, just putting any amount, like any dollar term on a single Bitcoin is insanity because it's the wrong measure. You know, it might make sense to talk about it in gold compared to gold, but also that, you know, we saw other precious metals devalue and completely demonetize, silver, for example. So you might want to talk about it in terms of how many acres you have, like, take the size of land that is kind of usable on Earth, divided by 21 million, and that's your worth of a Bitcoin. And just forget dollars and euros. They'll die anyway, with or without Bitcoin. You know, like the average lifetime of a global currency is like 100 years or 90 years or something. And the dollar is creeping up to, I don't know, probably 105 or I don't know. I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but the dollar is at the end of its lifetime. If you look at
the current form, yeah, it's... 1913, right, was the Federal Reserve Act, and
yeah, there you go. So a little bit over
five.
And so it's once you put all these puzzle pieces together, it just kind of becomes obvious that hyper Bitcoinization is inevitable, and we're living in Bitcoinization right now, and it will just take time to play out. And I wrote about that a couple of times. It's just a process that will take its time to play out, just like also to use the same example over and over again, internet adoption. It was clear it was definitely clear in the beginning of the 90s that the internet is superior on so many levels compared to other telecommunication devices that it will win out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people realized that and they built businesses around it. And that's why we have Amazon and Google and whatnot. And it was just crystal clear from first principles. It just doesn't make sense to use regular letters or the fax machine or I don't know, you know, like the telegraph or Morse code. It just doesn't make sense. We have the internet now. The internet is the proper tool to use if you want to communicate anything that is information. So it is the best medium for transferring information. And Bitcoin, now that we have Bitcoin, if you want to store or transfer value, it's the best medium. It's the best tool, like hands down. It's like 10x better than gold on every measure. It's except for how long it's been around. You know, gold has been around for like 5,000 years plus as a form of money and as a store of value. Bitcoin has been around for like 12 years, so it's laughable in comparison.
Yeah.
But still, you know, we have it now. And the only thing that you realize is what does it take to bring it down? What would need to happen that Bitcoin doesn't exist anymore? And it almost like my conclusion is, it would be almost as catastrophic as trying to remove gold. You know, like if the simulation stops, or if an asteroid hits or something, if we have like a civilization ending event, then gold is useless as well. And I think the same needs to be true for Bitcoin, because it's so insanely resilient. To shut off Bitcoin, that's what you would need to do. You would need to wipe out everyone on Earth. I used the example before of stamping out every ant on the Earth, you know, like stamping out an anthill, that's doable. Stamping out five anthills in an area, that might be doable, but it's already really hard. Killing off all ants simultaneously, because you will have to do it simultaneously, otherwise they reproduce again on the Earth. Like, that's a very hard task. It's not undoable, but it's really hard, you know?
They can't even kill the rats in one city.
Yeah, there you go.
Life itself just proliferates. It's extremely resilient. It's part of the nature of the universe, right? And if Bitcoin, like you say, is a new form of life that survives and that replicates itself, pretty wild to consider the implications of that. And with it being new, I would even venture to think, like, one of the things you mentioned in one of your articles is that it's a return to earlier technology, or it's like Bitcoin is somewhat old technology in a lot of ways, almost a return to ancient wisdom in a lot, as we're like figuring out how to communicate a widely distributed source of truth for humanity. You know, a source of truth is as old as civilization. So in a lot of ways, it's a very old technology and a very proven way of operating a society that's based on truth and honesty and verification, rather than the fiat unproven fiat way of like living life.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of truth to be found in old writings, and like the civilizations that were stable for thousands of years or even hundreds of years, like our civilization is kind of young, the like Western post enlightenment world. So if you see what they wrote, and also most of the major religions, they knew that if you start to fuck with the money, things go really bad. So a lot of the major religions, they, for example, they don't allow manipulation of money, even when it comes to lending money. So usury is a sin, for example, that you're not allowed to earn interest on just money, you know, like without putting in any additional work. It's kind of cheating the unwritten laws of the universe, you know. And the same goes for using hard money, you know, like I think even in the US Constitution it is alluded to that debts can only be settled in silver or gold. And there's a good reason for that, you know, like people a couple hundred years ago, or even a couple thousand years ago, they were really smart people. Like, you know, we like to think of ourselves oh so highly, that we are so smart and we figured it all out. But a lot of the things were figured out a couple thousand years ago. And if you read religious texts and, for example, the Stoics, they figured out a lot of things, and they're way smarter than most of us are. And money is a big part of that, you know, like money is a big part of civilization in general. Like it's as big of a deal as communication, and money in some very important sense is communication. So it is as big of a deal as language. And you're not allowed, if you want a civilization to be stable, you're not allowed to willy-nilly mess with the language. Words have meaning, words are important, and you should choose your words wisely and not mess around with them in just like remove, if you remove any meaning, then discourse is not possible. And we only have discourse or war. That's the only two, the only two methods to resolve conflict. So manipulating language leads to war, and also manipulating money leads to war. That's how I see it. And the ancient people knew that, you know, like that's why gold is, gold has like, in historically speaking, almost a quasi-religious godlike status. Like I saw quotes and old texts that declared that gold is a living god, you know. And it's so funny because we see it now repeated in Bitcoin, you know, like a lot of Bitcoiners, myself included, like to
deification, kind of
allude to Bitcoin. Yeah, to the, but it's, you know, like it's half jokingly, but it's also not, because I think Bitcoin is, as you said before, it's like this, it's bigger than us. And it's kind of, it's its own force of nature, you know, like it's just like the rising sun and the stars. You can rely on Bitcoin, you know, like if you truly understand it and you realize how it operates and what it would take to shut it down, in the same way, like you can rely on the sun rising tomorrow, you can rely on blocks coming in tomorrow. Like, you know, a lot of things would have gone wrong in the universe if the sun won't rise tomorrow. And similarly, a lot of things need to go wrong in the universe for blocks not to come in tomorrow. And so it's not, you know, it's not complete insanity to equate those two in some sense. But still, to go back to the original point, I think it is kind of old technology, but it's obviously it's also not, you know, like there's a lot of cryptography and fancy stuff involved, but still it behaves like very old technology. Like it very much behaves like gold, but gold on steroids. Like I really love the Murat's quote. He said like Bitcoin is super gold flying through an unstoppable PayPal. And that is so true. You know, like it truly is. It's way better than gold. And it's
super
also,
gold flying through a what?
An unstoppable PayPal. So it's, you know, it has all of it built in. You can just teleport it anywhere. And the way I like to think about it is to, and you also mentioned truth, you know, and how Bitcoin embodies truth. And money in a sense also is a language for truth in the sense that it tries to keep track of who owes what to whom. So it's a truthful statement of who did what and who provided what value. Like you provide some value, you create a product or a service, or you build a house or whatever, and you get some money in whatever form. And this is just a testament to the truth that you actually did something. You did something for society, and that's how society rewards you. And money in a sense is just a claim on society at large that you get something back. You know, you can exchange it for anything you want, and that's how it works. And historically we had two ways of embodying the truth, and it was tokens and letters. And it doesn't matter how many people talk about tokens in the digital space. There are no tokens in the digital space. A token has to be physical because of the double spending problem. You know, like only physical tokens exist, because the idea of a token is, like if you have a small household with small kids, like if the kid does its homework, you might give him like or in the casino, you know, you get a chip. And the idea of the chip is the small poker chip, you can't duplicate it. You know, you only have the one, you have to earn it. And the truth in what happened lies in that chip. Whoever has this bearer asset, whoever has this chip or this dollar bill or this gold nugget or this gold coin or this silver coin, you know, this person did some work, was useful, provided value. I mean, of course, you know, there are thieves and so on and so forth, but in the grand scheme of things, that's how it works. And the second way how we can decide what truthfully happened in the past is with letters. And so writing down what happened. So I gave you five bananas, you gave me 10 apples, you built the house, that's how much I owe you, and so on and so forth. And letters are as old as language. So the oldest written artifacts pretty much we found is pretty much a letter that says, you know, John owes 5 bushels of wheat to whomever.
Right.
And so all of this is,
it was all on rocks. All documentation started on rocks.
You had to you had to document it somehow. And I think it's really interesting to just go back to first principles and think very deeply about it, because tokens, in a sense, they are distributed, you know, everyone gets a coin and the coins flow freely, and you don't have need to any oversight. Like, people just, you don't need any centralization when everyone has coins, you know, you just change them, blah, blah, blah. You, when everyone has tokens, you know, you, it doesn't matter if it's seashells or pearls or diamonds or whatever have you, or even salt or cattle, all of it, like, the truth takes care of itself just by how the informational system of the society redistributes those tokens, and they do it by free interaction. If you have a ledger, things get really complicated, because you introduce centralization, and whoever has the ledger, he can cheat. He can, you know, make up cattle in his column and just, yeah, you owe me 5 cattle now. What are you going to do about it? The ledger isn't lying. And it's also a synchronization problem. You know, everyone has to run to the guy who has the ledger, and it's like, yeah, I really gave John those 5 apples, and so on. And Bitcoin takes these two ways of writing down what happened, pretty much, of embodying truth. And it kind of perfects them, and it takes the best of both worlds. You know, it is a ledger, but it also works by utilizing your private key, which acts like a token. It really isn't, because you can't copy your private key, but Bitcoin performs this intricate dance that it makes copies of your private key useless. You know, the truth the truth of the matter is not in your private key. It's on the ledger still. And your private key is just a way to unlock things that are stored on a ledger. And so it's not really a token, you know, but it's also important that it exists. Like, there is no, you have this distributed nature of the tokens, so everyone has their own private key, but you still have the truth for all to see in the shared public ledger. And I think it's so beautiful, and it's so important, and it's so misunderstood, you know, it's so misunderstood. It's like beyond belief. Like, yeah. Like, everyone who's talking about a blockchain just immediately ignore them. it shouldn't even exist in anyone's vocabulary. Like, if people start talking about the blockchain, they probably haven't thought about it deeply enough, what this actually is and represents.
Yeah. I'm just like sometimes my mind is just blown all the time. Like, I'm sitting here talking to like a cartoon character on the internet who's like, you know, a ghost from the future, about this internet money that has these properties that are so just radically like fundamentally different from what we have now, than what exists. When I look outside, and when you go to interact with normal people in business, like, what is that like for you? Just being, because you've been involved
talking
in
to
it
normal people. Is that the question? What is it like to you to talk to normies?
kind of, yeah. Like, the. I love talking to normal people. Because I like to explain, you know, some of these ideas, and even though I seem crazy, I you know, it's cool. I'm okay being a crazy person sometimes, but it's fun to watch, you know, the light bulb go off sometimes, and to kind of walk them through some of these principles that you've incorporated into your personal understanding. Do you feel the same way, that it's almost like there's a dream world happening in Bitcoin world, in Bitcoin land, but then there's like the real world, but then the real world is starting to seem more like a dream than Bitcoin land?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the question is, who are the crazy ones? You know, like, I ask myself all the time that question, and it definitely feels like a dream world. Like, it still feels like a parallel world, even though I think the worlds are merging more and more, and Bitcoin is entering the mainstream consciousness. And I always love to see that you know, Bitcoin Twitter memes end up on CNBC or whatever. You know, like, if you actually see it discussed in Congress, and you know, it's in the congressional record now that, you know, there's Bitcoin and there's shit coins. And so all of that is just beautiful to see. So in the end, you know, there is no hard distinction. I don't draw a hard line between serious conversation and memes, for example, and I don't draw a hard line between you know, the Bitcoin world and the real world. But it's definitely hard to talk to people that are deeply embedded in the legacy system, as I would call it, you know, like, it's, some people call it the fiat system or the fiat world. To me, it's just a legacy system. Like, it's not necessarily completely, I don't know, you know, like, most people that are wound up in that system still, they're not evil, you know, like, they're just trying their best to live a normal life, to provide for their family, they have a 9-to-5 job. They just, you know, who wants to think about politics? Who wants to think about the nature of money? No one. So if politics kind of works and if money kind of works, you don't have to think about it. It's the same for your car. It's the same for your computer. Nobody wants to know how a computer or a smartphone works. It only gets interesting when the things break down, you know, then you kind of have to figure out how it works, because you want to know how to fix it. And you can, you know, like, there's also a distinction. Certain things, I think, you can fix quite easily. Like, if you have an old car and it breaks down on the freeway, you can kind of get curious and maybe see something's not right and it's too hot here and there's a cable hanging out, whatever, and you plug it back in, maybe it works again. But, you know, like, there's some other systems. If your iPhone breaks down, there's pretty much nothing you can do, you know, like, it's that's how I see the economy at large. You know, like, if politics and the economy breaks down, most people flee the country. A war breaks out, some people rise up, but there is no way to kind of just fix the system after a certain point. And it's kind of sad, really, that most people are still in this kind of fiat slumber, so to speak, because if you're just looking around, it's obvious that the breakdown has already kind of started. And especially now with the acceleration of things, thanks to COVID, like, we have trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars printed and injected into the system. And I think this won't end well. It especially won't end well for people that don't have any hard assets, you know. And so it's really, I think that's especially hard for Bitcoiners to just talk to quote unquote normies, because of course everyone complains about certain things and it all leads back to Bitcoin as far as Bitcoiners are concerned, you know, most of the things are societal structural problems. And most of those problems are rooted in money, because money and politics are so insanely intertwined. And it's just, you know, the people at the money printers are making the rules, and the rules are fucked up. And that's why the system is fucked up. And also the incentives are fucked up. You know, like, again, it's not necessarily that everyone is evil and there's like a group of five people that have their super evil plans to take over the world, even though that exists as well. You know, like, I'm not saying that doesn't exist, but but still, most people are driven by incentives. Yeah. Most people just want to bring food on the table and take care of the family and live a kind of normal, happy, somewhat safe life. And it's just that the incentives are fucked up, you know, like, it's weird. It's a weird world. And to answer your question, like, how do I feel when I talk to normies? So first of all, I don't. That's just my reality changed so much that pretty much all my friends are Bitcoiners. And so yeah, it's, there are very few people that aren't Bitcoiners that are very close to me. And when I talk to, you know, like, of course I still have contact with other people and just normie people, but my trick is always to talk about Bitcoin without talking about Bitcoin. Never mention the B word, you know, like, the B word especially is a dirty word, but also just talk about privacy, talk about government overreach, talk about inflation, talk about maybe monetary policy or monetary history, talk about like the problems of centralization, for example. You know, everyone understands deplatforming. Everyone who is young and follows a YouTuber and the YouTuber got deplatformed, everyone understands that. Everyone understands the problem with that. Most people understand the problem with Facebook. You know, most people understand the problem with Google hiding search results. Most people understand the political problems that also can lead back to, you know, the problem of centralization and censorship and those kind of things. You know, you don't need to talk about censorship resistant money. You can just talk about censorship. And I think there is like a million ways to talk about Bitcoin without talking about Bitcoin, really. And I think that's how you can make people interested in the underlying issues, you know, and everyone knows that there are underlying issues. Like the world isn't perfect. It's far from it, you know, especially if you look back in 2020, you know, like yeah, everyone knows the world isn't perfect and there's a lot of things to talk about. And the funny thing is that literally like Bitcoin fixes this, like a lot of the issues we kind of see, it also resolves around truth, you know, and you can talk about fake news and truth and what it means, how to best find out the truth today, who you can trust. You can talk about all those things. They are all related to Bitcoin. You know, like Bitcoin in my mind is the truth machine. It is like the most trustless system we ever invented and so on and so forth. But you don't have to talk about it. You can just talk about the woes of society currently that resolve around trust and truth and centralization and just incentive structures that are not aligned with what's best for society, let's say. So that's my tip to all the Bitcoiners.
It kind of reminds me, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners talk about Bitcoin being somewhat of a religion and or cult. And there is this funny thing where the insiders, we get very excited about, you know, talking our language and kind of, you know, speaking to other people who align with, who we see eye to eye with. And, you know, for me, just hosting this podcast has been extremely exciting to get people on and talk about these ideas more in a more in-depth way, where there's not that initial barrier of like, of just believing that Bitcoin is the answer. Like we kind of get it. So you can kind of like take a step further, and it's really fun to explore deeper ideas with people like that. But then, but it reminds me of like kind of my previous religious experience in Christianity, where there was this idea of like God talk and Christianese, where people in the church would just get so, you know, hyper excited about their own inner club. And then just be completely irrelevant to the outsiders or people kind of looking in. And so there's this funny dynamic of like Christians trying to like learn how to evangelize, how to like be more relevant to the outsiders. and I kind of see like the same sort of like attitudes or like ideas emerging in Bitcoin, where it's like, no, guys, we got to like, you know, speak a language that the normies can understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Like there are a lot of parallels. That's why, you know, like it's always talking about Bitcoin and religion for me is always like half joking, but you know, it's also,
right.
It's also quite serious because I think it is, you know, like in the end to me, and that was one of my mental breakthroughs that almost did me in. I realized that religions in the end are just big memes, very powerful memes, you know, and Bitcoin first and foremost is an idea. So before like the idea of Bitcoin has been around for ever since the cypherpunks started writing about it, you know, like 60s, 70s. Mm-hmm. And so Bitcoin in a sense existed already as an idea, and the current Bitcoin core implementation embodies this idea best. And there are other implementations as well that are in consensus with the Bitcoin protocol, but it still is an idea. And it builds this feedback loop that feeds on other ideas. And if there are other good ideas, they will be implemented in Bitcoin. So Bitcoin kind of sucks in value. It also sucks in people, and it also sucks in ideas, you know, and it all kind of transforms then into code. And it is this expanding black hole. I wrote about this in Bitcoin's Gravity, how Bitcoin is kind of made of ideas, people, code, and nodes. And it's this feedback loop that reinforces each other, and it creates value out of it. And so starting from the idea, you know, like Bitcoin is an idea and was implemented, and it still embodies this idea. So it kind of is this meme, and you can see that Bitcoin is this rallying cry, and people rally around it, and you have a lot of people just creating art and memes and shit like that in the Bitcoin mm-hmm. space. And it's like you said, you know, like it's going out and evangelizing to some degree in some sense. And to me, it was suddenly obvious that like a Bitcoin religion, it will exist, and in my opinion, it already exists. Kind of, you know, like people talking about the Bitcoin cult, they say it in, you know, like they try to play it down, but I think people don't really appreciate how Bitcoin changes the individual. I would put myself on that list as well, but I think every Bitcoiner kind of knows what I'm talking about. You know, like there's this the pre-Bitcoin you and the post-Bitcoin you. So, you know, like you're a born-again Bitcoiner. And the level of conviction 100%. That kind of goes along with that, that's not priced in, you know? Like, there are so many Bitcoiners that are willing to go down with the ship. Like, it's Bitcoin or bust, baby. It's just, this thing has to work because it's our only chance. There's, you know, this is the arc. That's the only thing that kind of makes sense in this kind of chaotic and yeah, truth denying world, you know? And so there are many people that are definitely like, for me, there is just no other word to describe it best. You know, they are religious about it. They're willing to die for the cause. They're willing to go down with the ship. As I said, you know, like it's insane to you but you have to use this language because it's true. There are people that, you know, they drop everything for Bitcoin. Like there are so many people, again, myself included, I quit my fiat job. I kind of self-isolated even before COVID for like 2 years, did nothing else. And I just was, you know, I said this before, you know, like I really love the quote of Aaron Swartz. He said, you literally have to ask yourself every day, what is the most important thing I could be working on right now? And if you are not working on that, why aren't you? And this is such a powerful quote. You know, I have it printed out since, I don't know, probably like 5 years, and I've been sitting on my desk every day, you know? And for me, the last couple of years, probably like the last 4 years or so, the answer was crystal clear. And it took me a while to take the plunge and quit my very well-paying, very secure day job and just say, fuck it, I'm, you know, as others have said, you also have to burn the ships, you know, like you have to go all in. You have to go all in to see through. You have to be serious about it, you know, like there are Bitcoiners that are serious about this. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to be serious about something. You know, I also don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to be serious about your religion. You know, it's you in life, you have to make sacrifices always. You know, there is no free lunch. You always have to decide what to do next, and you always have to give up other things. And it depends on your level of conviction. And it also depends on how much you believe in it and how much you think, how much good will come from it, you know? And the nice thing about Bitcoin is, and I think this is what the maximalists have figured out, that it's not only good for yourself. So it's not about the gains, you know, it's not about getting rich on Bitcoin. It's good about, like, a lot of Bitcoiners speak about multi-generational wealth. So it will be good for your kids. It will be good for your family. It will be good for everyone who is in your tribe, so to speak. And it will be good for society as well. As we said in the beginning, you know, a lot of those societal woes, they all lead back to the broken system and the broken money. And Bitcoin literally fixes this. Like, Bitcoin is here to unfuck the money. And once you realize that, it's not outrageous to focus your whole life on this cause and on this issue. So I'm not surprised in the least that people are religious about it. And again, you know, like I don't mean that they go to some Bitcoin church or you know, do satanistic rituals or anything like that. There's just, you know, like it's
I'd be down to start a Bitcoin church with you, Gigi.
Yeah, of course. You know, like we'll have sermons and everything. Like,
yeah.
No, I'm sure it will come. You know, it's just
all the way.
Give it time. Give it time. Low time preference. Low time preference. but anyway, you know, like religions to me are about what is most truthful. What is in your hierarchy of values? What is on top? You know. And for many people, that is God and of the God of their particular religion. And that's how they orient their life. You know, like you have to orient yourself around something. And I think Bitcoin can be this beacon of truth, this larger than life thing. You know, like I really like Nick Carlsby's Bitcoin at 12 that he published recently mm-hmm. when Bitcoin turned 12 years old. And he talked about how people build cathedrals, multi-generationally. So you worked mm-hmm. your whole life on a single cathedral, just laying bricks, and you never saw the final cathedral. And that was just a normal thing to do. And your whole family, like your son became a stone, a bricklayer as well, and worked continued to work on the cathedral. And I feel mm-hmm. like Bitcoin is this kind of thing as well. You know, it's definitely a multi-generational effort, even though I'm super bullish. I think it won't take that long since we live in a kind of exponential world, you know, and Bitcoin is an exponential technology built upon exponential technologies. So I think it could be over in like 20 years, you know. I think we will hit the knee of the S-curve in like 8 years from now. So 2029 is my hyper-Bitcoinization prediction. And it's all of it is insane to think about it, but it's not surprising to me, you know, like... Once you understand that Bitcoin, I truly think it's that simple, you know, like once you understand Bitcoin can't be shut off, it is the rising sun, you know, and you can rally around it. And people, before there were organized religions, they deified the sun because it also gave life and so on and so forth. And it was very predictable. And I see Bitcoin as a similar thing, you know, it's outside of human control, even though it's human created, it's outside of human control. And I think that's, mm-hmm. it's a beautiful innovation. Yeah.
Yeah, that the whole ideological aspect of things is really fascinating for me, because and the relationship of ideas interacting together, the idea of memes, kind of, because that's coming from a lot of different areas, right? Like Richard Dawkins talked about the idea of memes, how you have self-replicating idea structures that are kind of possessing human minds and progressing themselves through time. And I wonder if you have ever heard of reality transurfing by Vadim Zeelin?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. It's a really fascinating book that kind of takes a more esoteric view, but also looking at a lot of the science. He calls them pendulums because he focuses on more of the polarity nature of them, where these idea structures sort of utilize the polarization of human emotion and of tribalism to kind of like
get their ideas to take over other ideas.
And I just wonder, like, to me, I need to do a better job of like summing that up and making it a little more clear. But to me, I almost see Bitcoin as this larger pendulum, where there is an inevitable like inclusion or exclusion, and really a polarizing, it is a polarizing force to for humanity, and it is subsuming all of these other ideologies in some ways. It's like it's absorbing all the value in the world, as well as people from various ideological backgrounds and various beliefs are coming, being led into Bitcoin and seeing how it relates and helps their particular position in life. And, but I, my question, I guess, is that, is this just, are we just being, when does Bitcoin not need us anymore? I guess is one question, like, you know, is as this new life form, like, because the idea with these memes and pendulums is that they're sort of non-personal entities. They don't really care about their adherents. They just, it's kind of a symbiotic relationship, but then when the adherents deviate, the pendulums destroy them. So yeah, I wonder if you've thought about that, like whether, yeah. Like, I know it's super like futuristic thinking or out there, but
I don't think it's that much out there. You know, like I thought about it in a little bit of a different context. Like, currently we're definitely living in symbiosis with the Bitcoin organism. There is no denying that. Like, Bitcoin needs us. It needs people to operate the mining infrastructure and stuff like that, and running nodes and also patching it and so on and so forth. I'm not sure if this will be always the case. Like, I think a lot of Bitcoiners agree that the Bitcoin base layer should ossify. So in terms of software patches, nothing should happen. Like, you know, I cannot stress enough how early we are, you know, like we are still in the reward era of Bitcoin, and the reward era, you can kind of, you know, like calculate when it's going to end based on block height. So it's going to end in like 2140. So we'll still have like 120 years of reward era left. That's where Bitcoins are being actively mined, you know, and in 2140 thereabouts, we'll hit the 21 million limit.
So the reward era is specifically referring to the block rewards being awarded to miners. Exactly. Okay.
Exactly. That's the era where there is still a block reward, like an additional incentive aside from the fees to mine new blocks. And this will end. This will end in 2140. I just want to visualize. I just want to tell people how insanely early we are, because Bitcoin will still be around after 2140. You know, it won't just magically disappear or stop or whatever. And right. So, you know, like if we are right about all that, you know, like if this is indeed not a simulation, and it will stop. So it's not outrageous to think that no additional software patches will be necessary at some point in time, broadly speaking. You know, like there are other protocol layers that pretty much ossified. You know, there are some encryption libraries that weren't touched in I don't know how many years. They're like, you know, the IP stack, it just works. You know, like you don't have to mess with the very, very base layers of the internet protocol stack anymore. And you don't have to rewrite assembly sub optimization layers of some compiler, so what have you. You know, like there are some things that were just done and that's it, and it works, and that's what we use and it doesn't change. And so what I'm saying is that Bitcoin core developers might die out. You know, you probably don't need Bitcoin core developers in 100 years from now. I'm you know, I'm just spitballing. I have no idea. Maybe we will need them forever, but who knows. If it truly ossifies, then we might not need them anymore. And the interesting stuff will move to higher layers, as it is already happening. You know, like most people that are actually actively working on Bitcoin are actually not working on core. Like they are working in Lightning and on ramps, off ramps, and application layers, and so on and so forth. In terms of mining, you know, it's not outrageous if you come from the futurist crowd. It's not outrageous to have completely autonomous mining facilities that just kind of upgrade themselves, take care of themselves, pay a maintenance crew themselves. Maybe the maintenance crew will be robots, but you can earn Bitcoin as a mining facility, and you can pay your staff in Bitcoin. So it's not outrageous to like far in the future, just think 100 years back, think 500 years back. And now imagine what's going to be possible in like 500 years from now. So maybe we will have fully autonomous mining entities that earn Bitcoin and just take care of themselves, and that will be it. who knows, you know, right. there might be still, like, you know, one human in the equation, like Jeff Bezos is now in Amazon, you know, like there will be one human on top just controlling all the robot underlings and all the algorithms, and he will make all the money. But right. It's not outrageous to say that some human aspects will go away. In terms of the pendulum destroying whatever interacts with it or is in symbiosis with it, that's a very interesting question, and it's not talked about a lot. Like, most people, right. especially now, very close to new all-time highs, are insanely bullish and just hyper optimistic and insanely, like, you know, the Bitcoin utopia.
As it should be. Of course. I'm all for that.
I'm definitely guilty. You know, I'm guilty of being bullish and optimistic. But I also think, you know, like I share Elon's sentiment. You know, it's better to be optimistic and wrong than pessimistic and be right. Like I don't have any qualms with optimism and optimistic people. I think the only way forward is to be optimistic. But I also think that we shouldn't be naive about it. Bitcoin will be no utopia. It already isn't. Like, Bitcoin is no utopia. Just like, you know, anarcho-capitalism is no utopia. Like, there, I don't believe in utopias. I think Bitcoin will fix a lot of things, but it's, you know, I know it's a sin to say that, but I'm going to say that anyway. Bitcoin won't fix everything. And there will be some unforeseen consequences, just like we had with the internet. You know, the internet was supposed to usher in a new utopia of, you know, like just free exploration of ideas, free access to information. And now we kind of have that, but we also have like the most insane surveillance state that, like, not even George Orwell had enough fantasy to come up with what we have today. And we have China. Just look at China. You can argue what's worse, in China, where it's done out in the open, or the rest of the world where it's done under the guise of the Five Eyes. You know, it's almost the same thing, but we're living in a dystopian reality already. And, you know, we have censorship and deplatforming and misinformation and fake news and just algorithms that are optimized for clicks and outrage and engagement, and pretty much they optimize for polarization. And that's what we are seeing in society. I don't think we ever had a time where every single issue, like, there's almost nothing especially in the US, where you have a two-party system, where both sides of the aisle can agree upon, you know, like every issue is decisive. And I think a large part of it is just the media landscape that optimizes for outrage and optimizes for polarization. And that's definitely a big downside of the internet. You know, I don't think we would have the same thing. I'm not saying all of it is bad necessarily, you know, like we have independent media like this podcast and many other podcasts. And just in general, I think it's a good idea that people can just throw crazy shit out there and see what sticks, so to speak. And I think I'm all for the free flow of information, and we kind of still have that on the internet mostly, you know, but it's also this kind of dystopian hellscape in a sense. And I think, you know, I think our blind spot in Bitcoin, I see that as one of the biggest blind spots. What will be the negative consequences, and what will be the things that are not utopian, but dystopian? And I can give you some examples and we see it already, you know, like we have ransomware attacks that wouldn't be possible without Bitcoin. So that's definitely a negative side. You know, like you can perfectly extort people now because of the nature of Bitcoin at the final settlement. And just to, since we were this kind of, we hit on these futuristic ideas of autonomous mining facilities before, I can see, you know, like once you have autonomous cars, you can definitely build autonomous kidnapping machines, you know, and you will only get out of this Tesla if you let the surgical robot remove one of your kidneys or you pay, you know, like you pay in Bitcoin.
Holy shit. It's getting dark. You know, like, yeah.
But you see where I'm going, you know, like there's a lot of things that are only possible in a hyper-Bitcoinized world. And not all of them will be good. But I think in general, the internet was a force for good and still is. And I also think in general, Bitcoin will be a force for good. Like, definitely. The current system is so insanely broken. And I think it's even true for the current media landscape. The current media landscape is so insanely broken. Like, it already is very ugly, but it will continue to be ugly until a new equilibrium is found. And I think the same is true for Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying at all like that this is something that should detract from our contribution or from our, you know, hashing this out. But it's, you know, I just wonder, you know, do you see some vulnerabilities in Bitcoin and right now in that same way? Like the fact that Amazon Web Services, for instance, hosts pretty much most of the internet traffic.
Yeah, definitely. Like the same is true in Bitcoin. The same will be true in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. We will have the same thing. Like most Bitcoin is held in custody. And this is about to change. Like there's some very interesting data from Glassnode that like every single price spike in the history of Bitcoin was like people just signing up for Coinbase accounts and just pouring money in and the Bitcoin stays in Coinbase. And now it's the first cycle now, the first price spike where it's the opposite. You see what Brady, Citizen Bitcoin, calls HODL FOMO, you know, like people are actually acquiring Bitcoin and doing self-custody. So that's a very good sign. But still, I think we will see a lot of the same centralizing forces because it's the same thing on the internet, you know, like hosting your own web server, taking care of your own domain. It's a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of responsibility you just need to take care of it. And so it's way, way easier to just create a Facebook page. It's way easier to just, you know, sign up for whatever, Squarespace or what have you. I don't know what's fancy nowadays, but it's just to go to a centralized service and let them take care of everything. And you just use that and you pay a little bit for it, whatever. And this, of course, centralizes things. And I'm optimistic because money is kind of different and people understand that, you know, like we will see more and more hacks still. I think, you know, we haven't seen the last exchange go down yet. I don't think we have seen the last exchange hack yet. And the numbers will just get ridiculous, not in Bitcoin terms, but just in US dollar terms. And so people will, I love the phrase of Alex Vetsky who says people will either learn through curiosity or they will learn through pain. And a lot of people will learn through pain and will just lose Bitcoin. And they will make sure to self-custody the next time or just do a smarter setup and move to multisig or what have you. But we see it already, you know, like we see just a lot of Bitcoin is in Grayscale, for example, you know, like that's the same thing. Then, you know, like Facebook hosting half of the internet pages or what have you. And I also think we will see it in the service sector that just like on the internet, you know, like you might want to use a singular service that might in the long run is not in your best interest. For example, like Facebook or YouTube or whatever. If you're a content producer and you just use YouTube, we've seen it over and over again. Like they will just deplatform you for whatever stupid reason and your whole livelihood is gone with a snap of a finger. And I think, you know, the same will be true in Bitcoin when you choose to use, I don't know, lending services, for example, that promise interest on your Bitcoin. And we will see that more and more of that because people are just greedy and stupid and just think, I will part with my Bitcoin and give it to whomever and I will get 6% interest on it. And, you know, like it doesn't take much for a company to bankrupt itself and then your Bitcoin is gone. You know, like there is no... There again, you know, you always have to make sacrifices. There is no free lunch. There simply is not. So you either choose the risk of third party custody or you choose the risk of self custody. There is no in between. Like either you shoot yourself in the foot while trying your own fancy cryptographic multisig setup that you just thought out. Not recommended, by the way.
Speaking from possible personal experience.
No, I don't. Luckily, I don't. Except for all the Bitcoin I lost in boating accidents, I never lost Bitcoin. So.
Oh yes, all right. Which happens to be all of it.
Yeah, it's a shame, but it's all water related incidents, not rolling my own crypto related incidents.
It comes with the lifestyle, right?
Yeah, just, of course, you know, like Michael Saylor, yacht, 5, 6, 7 yachts. I don't know, I lost count. but to come back to the point, we are already seeing that, and we will continue to see that, and we will see centralizing forces in the space, and people will just leave their coins with custodians, and those custodians will get hacked, or they will go bankrupt, or they will mess up themselves. You know, we saw all of that in the past, and I think we will continue to see it, because it's not super easy to secure Bitcoin. You know, it's kind of you need to know what you're doing, and for example, if only a couple of people have access to it, and then you decide to, I don't know, fly to Thailand for the Christmas party of the office, and the plane crashes and everyone's dead, and the only one who had access, like the three people that had access to the master password, are all gone. Like, I mean, those kind of things happen, and they will continue to happen, and suddenly all the Grayscale funds are locked up, you know. Thank you for your sacrifice. It would be nice to see.
Wow. Yeah,
but that's, you know, insane. Like all those kind of things, they are solvable, and a lot of smart people are working on protocols and technologies so that can't happen. And we did it before, you know. Like I don't agree with some Bitcoiners that say, for example, that nation states will never hold Bitcoin because they're just not equipped with dealing with private key material. Like, first of all, they already are, kind of. they have cryptographic keys. I mean, just look at that fucking NSA, for example. But also, right, just take something stupid like nuclear warheads, you know. Like this is critical. Those are critical things, and you need two persons to turn the key at the same time and so on, and you have access codes and whatnot. And I mean, just looking back in history, most of the security is laughable, but still, like, nation states kind of manage to do that if they have to, and there are protocols in place for running nuclear power plants and so on. And so it's very easy to set up protocols to also have a treasury of Bitcoins and do self-custody and a multi-sig setup, right? And I think more and more technologies and protocols will come up, and all of this will evolve so that you also move back to a kind of physical way of doing things, that everyone has their own cryptographic key, you know, and you have a multi-sig setup, and you need, out of those 15 people, you need 5 of them in the room, and everyone needs to have their own personal cryptographic key, and you plug it in to some machine and it will unlock the Bitcoin and so on and so forth. So I have no false illusions that only sovereign individuals will be able to hold Bitcoin. I think that's not true. We already see organizations holding Bitcoin, and governments are just, in some sense, very large organizations, so they will figure it out.
Right. I wonder, speaking, kind of bringing the nation states into the conversation here, you are obviously pseudonymous, and you are very conscious of what kind of information you let out about yourself. How do you see the future sovereign individuals interacting with the states? What do you see that relationship looking like in the next 5 to 10 years? Like you said, you're kind of targeting 2029 as a hyper Bitcoinization event. How do you see that playing out? Like I imagine it's interesting to say the very least.
Yeah, I have no idea how it will play out. I think it will, you know, as they say, it will be gradually then suddenly.
Right.
I think, I don't know, you know, I think it will happen step by step, kind of like it did with the internet, you know, like first it was just eating up all the letters of the world, like everyone was switching to email, and then suddenly it ate up all the phone communication because everyone switched to voice over IP. And we are still way before the voice over IP moment in Bitcoin. Like I've said this multiple times, but I can see a world where just the first bank snips with their finger and says, like, we have switched away from SWIFT and other settlement networks, and we are using Bitcoin and Lightning underneath to settle all our transactions. And now we are 50% cheaper, 90% cheaper than all other banks in the world. So we can offer you deals that nobody else can offer you. And this is a big deal, you know, like that's a voice over IP moment. And suddenly all the banks use Bitcoin as a settlement layer because it just makes sense. It's cheaper. It's more reliable. It's faster. And nobody, like most people are not thinking about that yet, but I think it will happen. Right. I think it has to happen. It's superior settlement technology. You either switch as a bank or you're dead, and banks will figure that out. So that's one like step towards hyper-Bitcoinization. And I think it will just happen step by step. And I think we will also see more and more organizations adopt Bitcoin as their standard. Like they will move towards a Bitcoin standard like Michael Saylor did, like many other companies did. And I think we'll see nation states, especially the small and corrupt ones, first move to a Bitcoin standard as well. Some argue they already do, you know, like in the background, they're already buying Bitcoin and so on. And, you know, like who has the most gold in this world? It's reserve, like it's central banks. So they kind of know what they're doing, and they will probably also know what they're doing in the future to some extent. And I think it can happen. It just can happen step by step. But also I think, you know, it takes a while for legacy systems to die, you know, like I still have to do some paperwork where they almost force me to use a fax machine, you know, like it's that bad. You know, some parts in Central Europe are just, you know, like 30 years behind, and it's just, you know, there's no way to do it online. You have to either come in person or fax it, and they don't take like a properly scanned in version of your document because it's too high quality. It has to go through a fax, so it looks kind of shitty, so they kind of knew it was really there, you know, like it's not photoshopped or something. I don't know. So we will probably still have fiat currencies for quite a while, but still I have the feeling that the collapse of fiat can kind of go quickly. But you know, everyone who is close to the power of the money spigot, they won't go away quietly, and we will see the rise of truly dystopian or Orwellian monetary systems with just central bank digital currencies and all these initiatives, right? The digital dollar and the digital euro, and everyone is working on it now. And you know why they're working on it? Because they have to, because of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is eating their lunch and they know it. And so they're forced to do that, and they will try everything to force this down everyone's throat. And it depends how radicalized you are already of how much you're going to take. You know, there are some people that will swallow it hook, line and sinker, and then negative interest rates will come in Europe. They're already there, you know? And so suddenly you're not only paying like 50%+ taxes, but everything that you're trying to save, like the government will come in and will just say, you know, there's now a 10% negative interest rate or whatever. And so for every $100 you put in monthly, we're taking 10. And it's just, you know, like some people aren't playing this game, are refusing to playing this game already. And more people, I think, will refuse to play this game. And as I said before, I think it has the potential to be very ugly. And it, you know, those kind of things usually lead to revolution and war and unrest, let's put it nicely. And so we might see that, we might not. You know, we haven't seen it with the internet. Like the internet kind of took over gradually, and it's very hard to say when the tipping point was. You know, like, I mean, some parts of the old media landscape fought it with tooth and nail, like, you know, the music industry, for example, and the movie industry and the newspaper industry and so on. They all lost, and they all had to abandon their old business models and switch to the internet. And now the New York Times is just another blog, you know, and the music industry, pretty much the only revenue they make it through streaming services, and things just changed, but they also changed for the better. I mean, you know, you can argue about that forever, but I think they changed for the better. We have made way more music now, way more access to movies, way more, you know, like there's Netflix now and many other similar companies that just produce very niche, like fractured stuff, so to speak. Just like the internet was designed for that, you know, like there's a billion blocks. Like if you want to read about how to best grow spinach in December, there's a block for that, I can guarantee you. You know, it's just insane. And there's probably wait another 6 years and there will be a Netflix show about it. You know, that's how it evolved. And I think Bitcoin has the potential as well to have a kind of, I think Bitcoin is the best chance that we have for a peaceful transition to a more saner society. And so hyper-Bitcoinization might be very hard to pinpoint, but I would argue once we start seeing the euro fail, things are already getting weird. And once we start seeing the US dollar fail, things are really getting weird. And I think fiat currencies are bound to fail anyway. And I see both of these currencies failing in the next 10 or 20 years, like 10, 15 years. And I think the next step will be that governments will try to step in and kind of do away with this failure by introducing digital currencies that try to emulate Bitcoin as closely as they can. Like, you know, they will try to say that it's the same thing, but obviously it's not. And this will fail as well. And yeah, then we'll see. Then I think the same thing to do is move to a Bitcoin standard. And I think the people that are ahead of the curve, they already know that, and that's what they already did. They moved to a personal or a company level Bitcoin standard. And just like the same thing to do, if I want to talk to you, I'm not writing you a letter. I'm using the internet. And governments are operating in the same way, you know? Like now there's a global lockdown. They want to have meetings. They want to have discussions. What are they using? They're not writing letters. They're using the internet as well. And I think the same will be true just for money in general. If you want to do business with someone, no matter where he is, no matter who he is, you will say, hey, what about, you know, like a 21% discount if we do it in Bitcoin? Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, that's fine. And that's how it's going to happen, I think. There was another question at the beginning, I think, but this long rant made me forget it. So sorry about that.
That's okay. I kind of was rambling myself. I'd love to, so for someone who's listening to this and is kind of like getting it, they're like, holy shit, I'm starting to see all of the picture come together. But where do I even start? What I love about your writing is like, you go so deep, but you're also, you elegantly communicate to people in a way that like kind of, you know, they're able to understand. And as I learned it, and as I traveled down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, I had the same experience. Like you talk about the being in that multiple stairway painting where you're like kind of confused. You don't really know where you're going because you're hearing all this like new vocabulary. But as you kind of go along, you sort of get your bearings. Where do you recommend people start? I'm somewhat question. Hinting at a shill for an event that might be coming up.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's the best place to start. As we talked before we hit record that it might be good to have like a, you know, Bitcoin bootcamp or just like a retreat, you know, like a 1 week meditation retreat where, except for not talking, the only thing you talk about is Bitcoin and how it kind of makes sense and everything links together. I think it would be useful. Like, you know, this baptism by fire is often very useful. It seems that Bitcoin clicks differently for different people. Like it feels like there's like a million puzzle pieces to understand it. And you don't know what the person is missing. And it depends on, like, when I talk to people about Bitcoin, or like, I stopped chilling long ago, actually. Like, you know, I went from chill lightly to not chill at all. I strongly believe that Bitcoin will be, I have this line, you know, where people will get Bitcoin at exactly the right time. And also people will get Bitcoin with a small KSB at exactly the right time. So the first Satoshis will arrive at your doorstep as you need them. And you will also understand Bitcoin and its implications at the right time for you. And for most people, it simply is not the right time yet. I still think so. Like a lot of macro guys, they talk about this being the last cycle and Bitcoin hitting escape velocity. I don't think so. Like it will take a bit longer than that. But most people simply aren't ready, like not at all. And it's very hard to point someone to one single resource and say, just read that and you will get it, because that's never the case. You just won't. You won't get it. You will need to immerse yourself probably for a month in very deep writing, very hard to understand writing. And it depends where you're coming from. Like I also think, even though it's not the most important and most interesting thing, but to truly understand Bitcoin, you also have to understand the technical details, because otherwise, you know, like don't trust verify. Otherwise you just have to believe It's crazy people like me that tell you you cannot shut down Bitcoin. But to truly understand why this is the case, you have to dig very deep. And if you don't know anything about physics and cryptography and computer science and mathematics, it will be very hard. You know, it will be very hard to understand why all of this is the case and why all of this is true and why all of this is provably true. You know, like, we're not pulling this out of our asses that we are saying Bitcoin can't be shut down. It's pretty much a matter of fact, you know. And just to understand deeply and appreciate it, you will have to do some work. But they're great resources. Like, it clearly depends on your background. Like, there are so many roots to Bitcoin. A lot of people come from a trading background. A lot of people come from a finance background. A lot of people come from a computer science background. A lot of people come from a libertarian background. You know, there are even some gold bugs that are starting to turn around. Some are just pure technologists and think it's cool to play around with those things. And there's so many different avenues that lead to Bitcoin, you know, also free speech maximalists, so to speak, like a lot of people that care about dissidents and free speech. And also, if you're on the fringes of society, if you're doing sex work or selling drugs, and just mind you know, like, not all drugs are illegal everywhere. So I'm not talking about illegal stuff. I'm just talking about Visa might not like to have you because your business is quote unquote dirty, then you might be forced to use Bitcoin. So all of those backgrounds are very, very different. And so it's really hard to point to a single resource to say, this is what you need to understand. And then it will finally click. Because I also think, you know, a lot of people, if you have to use Bitcoin out of necessity, it will make instantly sense to you. Like, if you're in Venezuela, you don't need to explain Bitcoin to people, you know, like, they all get it. They all get it. And if you need to do remittance payments, like if you're somewhere abroad and working for your family, and every time you send $100 back, the bank takes away like 50, then you understand Bitcoin immediately as well, you know, and you will switch to it in no time. And maybe you don't need to understand more, but to understand all the crazy talk that we just had in the almost 1.5 or 2 hours, you need to dig a little bit deeper, you know. Like, Bitcoin is much more than just remittance payments and just an inflation hedge. And I try to summarize what I've learned, but it just keep in mind, it's been quite a long time since I wrote that. I tried to summarize what I've learned in 21 lessons, so people can check that out. It's a free book. You can also buy it, but you can read it for free online, and guy was kind enough to read it. So there's a free audiobook version online as well. And I'm trying again. Like, I'm writing my second book currently, called 21 Ways, which tries to answer exactly this question. Like, I'm trying to write a book that talks about Bitcoin in 21 very different ways. So I will cover at least like 21 different people, you know. But I think there's way more, you know, like this. My book will also not be good enough. And so most people point to Jameson Lopp's page, which is bitcoin.page. And he has a lot of resources and beginner-friendly resources. Like, it links to, if you're really new to the space, then it links to some videos that explain Bitcoin like in 5 minutes. And then there's like a 20-minute video, and there's some interactive click-through where it will help you to understand how everything, kind of how the pieces fit together. I've built my own curated list of resources that if you want to waste, it's not wasted time, but if you have nothing better to do for the next 3 or 4 years, then this one's for you, like bitcoinresources.com. It's a long index of podcasts and selected podcast episodes and books, books that really helped me to make sense of it all. There's a lot of books. So just reading the books alone will probably take you a year or two. And many, many articles. I think the best place to learn about Bitcoin, truly learn about it, is probably Twitter, as weird as this sounds. But Bitcoin Twitter is basically the bar that everyone hangs out in. And just follow the right people on Bitcoin Twitter, and you'll learn in no time, because new articles come out all the time. And just if you look at Michael Saylor, for example, he went from zero to Bitcoin maximalist in like 3 months. And he was able to do that because there is so much great material out there already. And just if you look at Bitcoin resources and the list of articles there are a lot of great writing by authors that I consider excellent. And just read this, like, it's the Parker Lewis series, for example. Gradually Then Suddenly is what it's called. If you read it's, you know, it's a book. It's like, I don't know, 12 or 15 articles already, and they're really long, but that's a very comprehensive overview of Bitcoin and its implications and also how it works and so on. And I think the one that I point to the most is the bullish case for Bitcoin by Vijay Bhayapati, because it goes through the investment thesis of Bitcoin. It will tell you why Bitcoin is the best money we ever had. And it will go through the monetary properties of gold and other monies and will compare it to Bitcoin. And it will just lay out the bullish case for Bitcoin really clearly. I also think that if you have the background to make sense of it, read the Bitcoin white paper. It's one of the most amazing dense documents in computer science that I've ever read. And it's worth to read it and reread it and reread it. Like these 6 pages or how long it is, it's really short. They contain everything already, kind of, you know, like it's, and I'm not a white paper maximalist, but it's insane how deep it goes already. And also learn your Bitcoin history. There's a great book by, I'm blanking on the name who wrote it, but it's called The Book of Satoshi. I think it's Phil someone. You'll find it. It's The Book of Satoshi, okay. And you can buy it. You can buy it online. And
yeah, I'll try to put all these links in the show notes too.
Yeah, it's fine. Like all of that is on Bitcoin Resources anyway. So if people go there, they will probably find everything that I mentioned. And it's all the collected writings of Satoshi Nakamoto in chronological order, and with some context and with some explanations and so on. And that's really helpful because, you know, all the discussions that are had on Bitcoin podcasts and all the things that people argue about and all the FUD that is now coming up on CNBC and spooned out by news anchors and whatnot, it all was discussed back in the Bitcoin forums in like 2009 and 2010. So there is literally no new argument for or against Bitcoin since 10 years plus, you know. So it's really great to go back and just learn your Bitcoin history. That's what I would say.
it is true. Like, you don't want to just be rehashing some sort of something that's just been buried out of your own ignorance and kind of look like an idiot.
If you think you know why Bitcoin will fail, you can be sure that someone had the exact same idea on the Bitcoin forums in 2009 or 2010. So we went through all that and just look it up.
Oh man, that's awesome. Gigi, I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing. This has been great. I love your beta version of you materializing into cyberspace here. It's added a whole new element to the ushering in the Bitcoin Renaissance that we're doing right now.
It helps to blow the mind, you know, if you can't really see the person that's talking to you, but it's not moving. So I like that. Yeah, thanks for being a beta tester. I still have some things to figure out, but you know, it's like test number two. So worked out. Definitely. Yeah, thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun. I think I didn't expect to go on all these tangents, but I hope your listeners won't mind my rambling.
No, I find that I think it's just my own curiosity that kind of leads us to that point, and just the nature of what we're talking about. Like, this is a very big subject that, for me, has inspired me in very deep ways. So, like, I just want to help people see it from that lens, and as much as I try to help other people, help my friends and family to, you know, see the light, so to speak, there is this aspect of things where it's like, I am presenting them all of this material, and I've sent them, you know, your letter to family and friends, but there's only so much of that you can do. Like, I'm not gonna shove it down their throats.
Yeah, there's this old saying, you can lead a horse to an auto DCA service, but you can't make it stack. So you kind of have to be patient with your friends and family. It's just, you know, like the time to buy for the skeptics is at the new all-time high. So that's what I found out. But yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah, man. Well, thanks again. And hope to do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks again for having me, and you have a good day.
All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that talk as much as I did. I love Gigi's carefree demeanor and just elegant way of communicating some of the more complex aspects of Bitcoin in a really approachable way, especially for guys like me who are just, you know, a little slower with some of these things, understanding them and just kind of wrapping my head around it. Really appreciate Gigi. And be sure to check out more of what he's up to by following him on Twitter. Again, his handle is @DERGIGI and his website, DERGIGI.com. I'm really grateful for him joining me, and I'm grateful for you all for listening in. Before I close this out, I want to remind you to check out our Cosmic Deep Dive event coming up this weekend, December 12th and 13th. It's going to be an amazing chance to go deep into the rabbit hole with these amazing educators. You can learn more and register at cosmicdeepdive.com. Until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.